therefore, I believe, implies, if you like, democracy. It implies not merely winning the consent of others, other classes, and this is all the more necessary now that the working class is a minority class and its social base is a relatively constricted social base. Even if it extends its social base, it extends it to groups of people who are not quite the same as the manual industrial workers who once formed the core of it. It's got to restructure itself even in this way. But it's got to win the consent, but also it's got to provide ways in which people express their consent. But another point really does follow, an important point. Whereas power can be transferred or seized, if you like, hegemony can't. The two are two different things. One is, as it were, something which can be transferred by a once-for-all, if you like, step. Whether this is conceived as winning a majority in Parliament or a revolution like the October Revolution and some other. But hegemony, being accepted as the carrier, if you like, of a project, a political project, which is worthy to be supported and by the whole of the people, or most of the people, and which disarms the minority who resisted, this has to be won. And it has to be won usually, or a good deal of it has to be won before power is transformed. And Gramsci's insistence was that the struggle, as it were, to win the moral high ground, or the national high ground for the labor, is one which begins long before it's the setting up of a mass working class party, which was one of the main steps towards doing it. But unless that struggle is won and greatly advanced made before power is transformed, the capacity to change society is limited. Now this applies both to revolutionary situations and to non-revolutionary situations, I believe. Take, for instance, the classical example of a transfer of power by revolutionary means recently in Europe, which failed because the battle for hegemony had not been won. The Portuguese Revolution of 1974. No question about it that power was transferred. No question about it that the people who took power, revolutionary army officers and very largely communists who came out of jail and so on, were in a position and wanted to change. They failed. Portugal is not a socialist state now. It is not even very notably on the way to socialism, because even if you've got power, unless you then are in a position to introduce a dictatorship, cutting yourself from the rest of the world, as for instance a sort of left-wing Pinochet thing, you need support and you need consent, and there was not enough of it. The working class movement remained, as it is today, it remained a very important bloc within Portugal, but a minority bloc. And conversely, sections of the peasantry and of the middle class were never, as it were, won over to the movement. So, for want of this, even though power had actually been transferred beyond Olten, the capacity to change the society was severely limited. For the short term, fatally limited. If you look at the other hand, as an example which I don't like to quote because I don't like the people that have won the hegemony, namely the Iranian Revolution. The Iranian Revolution did indeed succeed in establishing hegemony, that's to say, that as soon as the Shah had been overthrown, the new regime, in a sense, because it represented, as it were, something which had legitimacy in the minds of most Iranians, particularly most poor Iranians, was able to make major achievements, of which one of the most impressive is precisely that of being able to wage a major war with enormous success against a better armed, though numerically smaller, enemy. Now, I'm not making a case for, God knows, the Ayatollah and his life, but what I'm pointing out is this: the difference between a revolution which, as it were, backs up this mere fact of overthrowing an old state machinery and taking over and putting a new lot of people, and the others. Now, in our country, Labour, however large a majority it might have, could not do anything without some kind of consensus or some kind of support, especially if it needed to be re-elected. But that's not the essential point. The essential point, I think, at present is this. The essential weakness of the Labour movement and the Labour Party today is that it has given up the struggle for the high ground. It has become too defensive. It is reacting towards other people's hegemony and saying, well, we're no worse than you are in this respect. And that, I think, is the wrong thing about something like the adaptation, the case that is made for socialism by people like Hattersley. For, you see, the battle for hegemony must be waged now and at all times. You can't wait. And what is more, it is must be waged in and through the day-by-day struggle. If I may just give you one example. If there is one case which is left in Britain at the moment, why people will say, ordinary people will say, yeah, well, Labour is better than the others, and the Socialist Party is, and socialism is a good thing, it's, I suppose, the National Health Service. It's the fact, I would say, that the existence of the National Health Service is one of the strongest arguments at the moment for Labour in this country. But the National Health Service was not, as it were, a revolutionary transformation. It was a particular piece of struggle, day-by-day struggle for the improvement of the of condition of the ordinary British people. But it was a form of struggle which was presented and which people recognized as implying a different kind of society, and a different kind of society which could not be organized in the sort of way in which Thatcher likes to organize their society. The second main political advantage of Gramsci is, I think, concerns the nation. Just because Gramsci saw the socially integrative elements in society, even in societies driven by the class struggle, and just because he saw that working class struggle as one to become the hegemonic force for all society, he also, I think, appreciated the significance of the nation within politics, and I believe provides an important base for integrating the concept of the nation not merely into Marxist practice, but also into Marxist theory. He did not see it simply as, quote unquote, the national question, something we've got to come to terms with, and we wish it wasn't there. That in a sense, the nation was an important, it was what most people, a shorthand term for society and all its internal cohesion. But I won't say any more about this now. The next major innovation in Gramsci's theory is the concept of a passive revolution. This is another way of saying that revolution doesn't have to win, and especially not if the ruling class, shaken by fear of revolution, reforms itself and establishes by these means a stabler and more viable base of operating. Gramsci thought of this very largely in terms of fascism, but also, in fact, in terms of good many counter-revolutionary movements of the past. Counter-revolution not simply as a reaction, as turning the clock back, but as conservatism which goes away and uses enough of the demands of the revolutionaries to disarm them. Bismarck, who introduced social insurance in order to weaken the Social Democratic Party in Germany, is a very standard example. Now, Gramsci was very strongly obsessed There is no historic inevitability about the revolutionaries winning if the other side can manage, as it were, to break off the sharp points, you see, of discontent by what he called the passive revolution. And of course the interwar period was a classic period, the New Deal, the Keynesian transformation of bourgeois policies, you see, was precisely one such attempt, and one which unquestionably transformed and weakened, and enormously weakened the revolution movement and strengthened the resistance of capitalism, even at a time when capitalism tended was broke down over large parts of Europe, as after World War II. However, we should notice that passive revolution is no more a miracle cure for all times than revolution succeeds in avoiding all future problems. A number of the passive revolutions of the past have in turn failed or ground to a halt. But nevertheless, the importance of this is that the concept of passive revolution means it doesn't have to be us that ensure historic changes. They can be ensured by the wrong side and by the other side too, and this with weakness. And the last major innovation is the idea that the transformation to socialism is a continuum which begins before the transfer of power and carries on, which also follows from Hegemon. It isn't that everything before the great day is in some sense irrelevant and building a socialist society starts when we're in power. I've already mentioned this in connection with hegemony, and indeed it's a corollary. But I want to mention it here again because it leads me to the very large and very important bits of Gramsci's thought which deal with socialism, when there's a socialist society, which doesn't concern us directly because we haven't got one. I'll just be brief about it, but I'll note in passing that they are enormously relevant to, say, the project of Gorbachev and all other attempts to reform a socialism which has got itself rather bogged down in the so-called actually existing socialist states. For Gramsci realized, as do these reformers, that politics and political institutions are essential to socialism. And in the past, particularly Marxist theory, has systematically underplayed them because it saw politics essentially as a question of power. And once that problem had been solved, nothing further really needed to be done. There weren't any further problems. The Communist Party in a socialist state, or the ruling party, represented by definition the working class or all the people, because there were no, as it were, class contradictions, there were no other basic differences which had in some sense institutions to be ironed out. Now the point is this, whereas bourgeois revolution produced virtually no mechanism for planning or organizing the economy, it left it all to civil society, it produced an enormous and elaborate mechanism for sorting out the political differences of one kind or another, preferably in a way which would not risk the existence of the system. Full of discussions, every bourgeois revolution produced new constitutions. Some of them doesn't change, doesn't at times. Now, as far as this is concerned, the history of socialism is that of a void. There is no provision, with the one exception, for instance, of national federations in Yugoslavia and Soviet Union. For practical purposes, very often the constitutions, even the constitutions which exist, are paper constitutions, they aren't supposed to do anything. Even the one active existence of democracy in a party democracy for long periods of time didn't operate. For practical purposes, socialist revolutions have been as completely blind until recently to the need to institutionalize politics. That's to say, the fact that there are people with different groups, with different interests, that these groups have to reach some extent sorted out against each other and in conformity with the interest of the whole of society. And it is very significant that an important element in the present reforming wave in socialist society, starting with Gorbachev but the others, is the need to introduce some kind of institutionalization of these political activities. Why does Gorbachev call for elections with different candidates? You see, why do people, if you follow the discussion, for instance, in Renashita, between people on the Gorbachev, were people like Bruce, the economist from Oxford, the Polish economist, who says this economic reform cannot work so long as there is a kind of centralized, bureaucratized political system. For these reasons, in fact, Gramsci shows that politics is an essential part of, an essential tool, socialist societies. In short, democracy in the bourgeois sense is not a luxury but essential, inasmuch as all societies, if they are to function adequately, require ways and means institutionalized to represent each other and to relate to society as a whole. They do not have to be our present Western pluriparty system, although probably in our own countries this will be the basis of a politics. And where these are needed, they are needed in one way or another in all societies. No Labour government could institute socialism if it came in by abolishing the House of Lords in a few months and then shooting ahead. It was when I heard Tony Benn say this sort of thing 5 or 6 years ago that I came to the conclusion that with all his great gifts he could not be taken seriously as a politician and as a socialist. There is, in present circumstances, no foreseeable way in which a Labour government would not have to face re-election. There is no foreseeable way in which it would not at least risk being defeated in a re-election. And therefore there is no foreseeable way of envisaging the socialist transformation of Britain, if it's ever to take place, except through a series of Labour governments, which ideally should be an unbroken series, but in practice they are very likely to be interrupted by reversals. That's the way it has to be. It's theoretically possible to conceive of other scenarios, but either they wouldn't work, as in Portugal in 1974, or they would lay up an awful lot of trouble for the socialist regime later, as has happened in parts of Eastern Europe. In short, one of the things we get out of Gramsci is that there's no way to transform British society from one day to the next. There's no way to do so without maintaining and extending decisive support from the majority of the British people. We can kid ourselves that somehow or other a replay of 1917 or something else is possible, but it isn't in any foreseeable way. Or we can throw up the sponge, which is what the reformist leadership of the Labour Party has done so often, and in effect settle for not transforming society. And then it is quite logical for some of them to join the Social Democratic Party, which says we're giving up transforming society. Or else, we can think along the lines of somebody like Gramsci, a revolutionary socialist who envisaged the struggle for socialism in very much the way in which we find, like it or not, that we have to wage it. A long, a difficult struggle, but a struggle which has good chances, I believe. He hasn't done our thinking for us. But 50 years after his tragic death, let us nevertheless pay our tribute not to the memory, but to the living ideas of that tragic little cripple who was probably the most original Marxist thinker of our time and one who has given us hope.